I'm Ingrid Christensen. Peter Nash just told me, asked me if I was going to be acting as the Norwegian half of a multicultural family in this form. The other half is German, and I said, well, yeah, I guess I am. So here we all come with our various cultures to talk about the multicultural families, or specifically interracial families, tonight. I'd like to mention the nature of forms at Holden. Forms are not places where we have a lot of speeches. They're places where we try to engage each other in discussion. So there's a lot of give and take, and we hope that many people in this room will take part in the forum. That's one of our main goals of the night, is to give lots of us a chance to speak. Another aspect of forums at Holden is that we do not try to arrive at the truth. We think that there are probably lots of things to be said about an issue, and that we can learn a great deal from one another, and that all of us have goodwill and our hearts are in the right place, and we're trying to come to grips with various issues. And tonight, certainly, the part of what we're talking about is racism, and that's not going to get solved tonight. So,
what's the point?
So we're not going to arrive at any great truth, but I think some enlightenment, some furthering of our thought about an issue is worth doing, and that's, I think, what we're probably after tonight. We're grateful to these folks that are willing to be panelists this evening, Leanne and Peter, and Netter and Verlon, and Sarah and Ed, but you are all on the panel in a sense. You're all sharing of your thoughts and wisdom. These families who are on the official panel up here are willing to put some issues in front of us and act as a resource. It's a common way that we teach here at Holden. We use personal stories and personal things about ourselves to raise up issues about society. And that's certainly something we're grateful that these folks are willing to do some of tonight. I think, though, that I'll begin with some questions that were sent to us during the winter, March 21st, earlier than that, by a family called the Vosslers from Vancouver. And they suggested, Debbie and Vic Vossler from Vancouver, suggested that during these weeks at Holden, we would talk some about multicultural and interracial families. And they had topics for sessions. They sent us a letter with great topics. So I thought I'd read a few of them to you, because some of them are real good ideas. And they might be things that we would get around to talking about tonight. The identity of mixed race children, including the positive aspects of being a part of more than one grouping. A discussion of certain problems that come during adolescence, dating, dress, hair, etc. Some concerns of adoptive parents of mixed race children, instilling a cultural identity in your children. Concerns for couples in interracial marriages, family reactions, bringing two different cultures together to form a new multicultural family, issues around children. And then they go on to say the main issues in this unit, or this set of conversations that they propose that we have at Holden, the main emphasis of the event should be, however, the celebration of the multicultural aspects of diversity within interracial families. I just thought there were some lovely ideas there, and I thought it was worth sharing them with you. They're not here. I wish they were.
Yeah.
Are they?
They're here. Yeah.
Are they right there?
Yes.
Well, thank you.
Why aren't they on the panel?
We're shy.
Well, thanks. We'll look forward to some further contributions from you. So that's a nice, I'm glad to hear that. I should have stopped on registration and asked if you were here. So I think with those sort of thoughts thrown out into the circle. I will ask each of these families to contribute some of their thoughts, and then we'll open it up for some discussion. And Sarah and Ed have agreed to start off. Sarah specifically, I think.
Well, where does one begin? When I hear, I had some things that I wanted to say, but then when I heard the letter, I thought, mainly because I guess I think about what is behind the questions, you know, and the question that I hear, that I've heard for years, has been the concern on the part of some people to be concerned about the kids, you know, and what happens when you have a child who is biracial, you know, black and white. Ed and I don't have that experience. This is our second marriage. I was married first to a man who was black, and we have three children between us. I have a child who is from my first marriage, who is now 17, and Ed has two children from his first marriage who are white, 27 and 24. And
I was married much younger.
Yeah. And I guess the issues that I perceive to be behind that question, those questions, have never really affected us in the same way in terms of our family. However, the issues that society deals with in terms of racism and how they have impacted my son, who is black and male, obviously, have been another issue altogether. And we lived about 9 years in Arizona before moving to Washington, D.C. And part of the reason for leaving Washington, leaving Phoenix, was to remove Brad from an environment where there's less than 3% of the state's population is black, and where he was always the only black young man in a school or in any place. And when he said to me he was afraid of black people, I knew we had to leave. Because the real issue there was him developing a sense of who he is as a black young man, and understanding the realities of this racist country, and understanding those realities in a way that he could feel good about for himself, feeling good about who he is as a person. And so that has been, I think we made a good choice when we decided to leave. In terms of Brad and Ed's relationship, what you can talk about that? I mean, if that's something. Well, I just think that, of course, we've got a blended family in more ways than one. Mm-hmm. We have a blended family. We blend years of experience in other relationships. In other marriages, I was married to a man who was black first. And if I didn't know before that this culture is white male dominated, I know it now, but I knew it then. Being married to a black man, the struggles that my ex-husband had to go through, who was an economist, you know, professional by our standards, are quite a bit different than those experiences that Ed encounters as a white man in this society. And my marriage to him makes my life different. And so our relationship is somewhat different. But there's no mystique about that, other than he's white and I'm black, and we deal with this racist environment as it is. And I'm open to talking about that in any way anyone wants to discuss it.
Thank you, Sarah. Actually, Sarah and Ed have a matching set of zebra t-shirts that that they sometimes wear and tell a story. I mean, it's silly for me to tell it.
Well, we decided... When we first got married, you know, we lived in Arizona. It's a crazy place. And, sorry about that. It was bizarre. And we decided that we had to have fun. Because every place we went, people stared at us. They almost had accidents on freeways. We'd walk into restaurants and people would turn around and stare at us like we were, you know, some Martian had just landed. And Ed would go, "Hi." And we decided that we needed to have fun with this. So what we decided was we had to find an animal that could best represent who we are. So we selected a zebra. And so we collect little zebras. Friends gave us a zebra cup, you know, mugs, and we have little zebras that we have around the house. And we found these shirts and said, have to have those. And in Arizona, we had a license plate that said Zebra 2 on my, I had a TR7. And so I'd be buzzing around town in my zebra with my Zebra 2 license plate. And people would ask me, when we were together, they'd say, "What does that mean?" Anyway, so that's.
I think
so. We decided that we could really start a zebra club, and that there we could have honorary members of the zebra club. Anyway,
I decided that any couple that goes around wearing a zebra T-shirt was fair game to be on this panel, right? Should we go on to you, Netter and Verlan? Do you have a spokesperson between you, or?
I'm not sure what to say. We don't have any children. You know, we didn't decide not to have children because of our race. We just decided not to have children.
And then you met ours, and
you said, "No way are we going to have children." I'm not sure. We've had, one of the things that I tell people is that one of the great things about our relationship that kind of frees us up is that most couples, they get married and then they spend the rest of their married life fighting because they expect each other to be the same. And I know Netter's different than I am. She knows I'm different than she is. And we just sort of accept it, you know, and we just kind of, you know, sort of live that difference. And I think it makes a difference in relationship because I don't expect her to be like me or come from the same point that I come from or that sort of thing. And it's sort of a freeing kind of a thing. And I learned from her and she learned from me. When we were in Denmark, I learned how to say, no, I didn't learn how to say it, but this Danish stuff that her aunt cooks, you know, I ate that. And and all of that sort of thing, and she cooks a pretty mean sweet potato pie. And, you know, so we just kind of, you know, the difference is, when you know they're there, you just sort of, we just sort of accepted them. That's sort of where we are.
I could say a little bit about racism.
Want to go away?
It really wasn't until, well, I grew up in a town in Stillwater, Minnesota, where I don't think any black people live.
There was one, you said.
Well, every once in a while, a black family would move in. and they would never stay very long. And it, I didn't really know why, but now I guess I have an idea. And I had never, I don't know, I guess I was racist like everyone is, but it wasn't until Verlon and I decided to get married that I really realized what racism was. My family up until that point had met Verlon and seemed to like him. My mother had this habit of kicking him, which was a sign of affection in our family.
Well, they didn't rub or touch.
Yeah. He just kicked.
Really, really love the dog.
And my mom would kick him, so I thought, oh, well, she likes him. And but once we decided to get married,
she
it was
kicking.
Yeah, it was really a different story, and my family was really resistant. And it got to the point where I had to say, well, don't make me choose between my family or Verlon, because you, my family, are going to lose. But it, I was shocked by the things they said, the things they did. I just had no idea how deeply ingrained racism was in people who up until that point didn't seem racist. And eventually they have somewhat accepted it. I mean, everyone treats us both civilly, but it's uncomfortable for me. I don't know if it's uncomfortable for you.
Well, your mother and sister.
Yeah, my mom pretty quickly accepted it, and my sister never had a problem with it. She's 10 years younger than me. So it's really the men in the family that were very much against it. And yeah, I guess, you know, the white father not wanting his daughter to, you know, marry a black man is, I guess, a pretty horrible thought to some men. But even as 3 years ago, my mom died, and I flew back to Minnesota from Washington, and so people were coming over to our house that, you know, I hadn't seen in years, and friends my father's, and my father actually took our wedding picture and turned it over so that no one would see it. People that didn't know that my husband was black, he did not want them to know. So, and that was just really, really hurtful to me, especially at that time that, you know, my mom had died, and it just was shocking to me that it would even occur to him to do. And a lot of resistance from family. Friends were much better. None of my friends were resistant to it. What are you?
Her aunt came to our wedding and the wedding reception, and you know, we had friends all around. Aunt Avis.
Oh, that's Grandma Avis.
Grandma Avis, okay. She came and she was sitting there, and you know, all our friends were around and something. And she just kind of turned around to some other member of the family and said, well, they all seem to like him.
Yeah, I think my family was shocked to find that we had friends.
Uh-huh.
You know,
yeah.
They thought that we
would
were
be outcast.
Out to, yeah, that we would, I mean, that my father said, the, you know, the only person he knew who was interracially married was Sammy Davis Jr., and he'd been divorced several times. So that was his modeling of interracial marriage, and Peter wasn't going to make as much money as Sammy Davis Jr., so.
Not with his cast on.
No.
There's another family member story that's kind of funny. My godmother, who grew up in the same town I did, and so she hadn't really come into contact with any blacks. The first Christmas after we were married, we went home to Verlon's parents, and then we went to my parents. And at my parents' house, we have a smorgasbord in between Christmas and New Year's, and it's many courses. A lot of you probably had a smorgasbord, so I don't have to explain it.
Courses of raw fish.
And after each course, you drink this very strong liquor called Aquavit, and then you have a beer chaser. Well, Roland doesn't really drink very much, and I don't either, but my family kept insisting that we drink this stuff. And Roland was, you were doing pretty well. I don't know if you were keeping up with my family.
But I thought, you know, if I drink this stuff, you know, maybe they'll like
it. So everyone was getting really silly. And
bomb.
My godmother ended up somehow kneeling in front of you.
She was kneeling at my, she had her hand on my knee, and she was, you know.
Well, she just, I think she was actually crying. And she told Roland that she had seen Guess Who's Coming to Dinner 6 times. I really liked it.
I haven't met this woman up to this day. There she is, drunk out of her mind, at my knees.
So there's a good story.
Yeah. Maybe Aquavit's a cure
for racism. Aquavit is a cure for racism.
Everyone turns green.
Ed, we certainly don't want to cut you off, so you should cut in here whenever you are ready to.
There is a lot of humor with it. Yeah, just in terms, you sense some of it tonight. And I think for us, as we began married life, we said we've been married 55 years to start with. And, 25 and 10, and then 10 together. They all count. And there is a lot of humorous things that, there are a lot of humorous things that happen. You know, you go through the checkout line and people don't put you together. And some of those are really funny. I think one that really got to me in Phoenix, shortly after Sarah and I were married, was a pastor there, a very respected pastor, who I went out to lunch with on one occasion. I was a director of the LSS agency there at the time. And he was a pastor who enjoyed having a lot of drinks at lunch. And after about 3, he wanted to know what it was like to have sex with a black woman. That's the ugly side. That's the ugly side. But there's also a lot of fun side to it, too. We were invited on one occasion to a church to talk like this about what it's like to in an interracial marriage. And there was one woman there who could not accept the fact that we said most of our issues are not racial, they're between male and female issues, you know, just like everybody else. It's two people, and we come and we bring who we are to that relationship. And yeah, there's racial stuff there, but most of it was simply a man and a woman trying to make an unlikely thing called marriage work, rather than anything else. But those are just some of the things.
Thank you.
But there are some cultural things. That, and one of them that struck me tonight was really funny. We were sitting at the table and Ron was there. And he said, well, the bread has to go all around the table in the same direction. And I got so tickled because Ed says, you know, all the food has to go around the table the same direction. when you go to a mall, you have to go to all the shops the same direction. And everything has to be very orderly and on time and all that stuff. Well, hey, you know, I'm one of these people who really likes to just feel it. And that's not necessarily black or white, but it's interesting for us that, for me, I think that some of that may be somewhat cultural.
But you miss a lot of shops then.
That's right. But I don't know.
Well, let's turn to Leanne and Peter. And do you have a spokesperson that wants to?
No, but I want to jump in here right away and assure you that not all Lutheran pastors ask these questions, because in 12 years of marriage, not one single black Lutheran pastor has asked me what it's like to sleep with a white woman.
There you go.
Not that any black Lutheran pastor.
Yeah, but I know them all. We hadn't thought about this much. One of the things that I just mentioned is the way that the relationship sometimes really cues you into racism. When Leanne was being appointed to a church in the far south, in one of the far south suburbs of Chicago, and they didn't pay the associate enough to live right in the community, and they didn't have a parsonage, Leanne went house hunting and got shown one set of houses. And when I came along, we saw another set of houses. And that was only 7 years ago. So that stuff that was supposed to have all been done with by law 25 years ago is still
very clear red line.
And you
know, and when we've looked at housing in other situations, the very same thing happens. It doesn't have to be on, you know, in the white flight neighborhoods of Chicago. It can be in liberal Evanston and other places too.
And when the thing about the checkout line, when I bop into a store, when it's not a black white thing, because I'm the one who wants to go around the mall.
In the same direction.
In the same direction.
It's a male thing.
No, I wouldn't do it too.
it's someone's in culture. At any rate. So when I try to find her in a store and I walk in and I say, is my wife in here? They go, no. Matter of fact, we're not sure we want you in here. When Carrie was first born, she had a lot of therapy going on, like, it was virtually constant. And we sort of traded off. And when Leanne, one of the first things that they do with handicapped kids is undress them and get them down to their diapers so they can see how their muscles move and so on. And week after week, Leanne came home with people commenting about what a great tan Carrie had. And they never said that to me. there are some funny things, and there are some very frustrating things. The thing that strikes me most. I think one difference might be in our relationship is that had our family moved to Stillwater, Minnesota, we would have stayed. we would have liked that status in the situation that I grew up in.
One of the things that is a problem that I have is when we go, we're on the road a lot. And whenever we go into a hotel or a motel, and Ed makes the reservation for us, and then I come, I always have the feeling, when people are looking at me, that I'm his woman of the night. Because of all of the racist stuff that has happened, and sexual stuff, that has happened for hundreds of years against black women. And when Ed and I first married, there were people who said to me, some of my relatives said, you don't have to do that. And the concern was, you know, it wasn't a concern. The question was, how could you do that? And I understood. I understood what they were saying. And for me, so often these kinds of questions really become questions about sex You know, and for me, I think that when people are really concerned about how black and white people come together, they're really not asking the questions of, you know, well, how do you get along as a couple? Oftentimes, I think that the question is, you know, how do you have sex like we do? How is your sexual relationship? And then what happens with the kids? And
I think that's what the what happens to the kids question is all about.
Yeah,
I mean, I think it's sort of easier for people to think of these as all platonic relationships, and that where it really gets difficult for white folk, especially, is just that whole issue of sexuality, which none of us are comfortable talking about, of sexuality and racism. And it's a powerful mixture that doesn't get talked about.
One of the things that we touched on just briefly last night in the forum is what we go to war for. And one of the things that we've traditionally gone to war for is to protect our woman folk from the brutes, whether they be Germans invading Norway,
Vikings invading Ireland,
yeah, whatever. We're going to protect our women folk from that other kind of person. And another thing that spins off of that is just in our relationship. Leanne grew up in about as deep of the South as you can get. She grew up in the Florida that's still really part of Georgia or Alabama, depending on which way the family moved down from. And after the first couple years, we stopped driving.
I heard that.
I'm talking about the liberty to move around. Up here in the North Country, maybe a couple places between here and Chicago, I wouldn't drive. Thinking of Idaho and a couple of those places where certain churches have a strong foothold. But pretty much in the North, we drive where we want, we go where we want. But there are a lot of places where we do still get funny stares in the North.
And the difference, I think, would be with us, with Ed driving, you know, the whole implication would be different. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's, you know, it angers me just as much.
Sure.
Let's open this up for a wider conversation. I'm riveted by what's going on here.
A wider, W-I-D.
A comment or question?
I have a question. In a forum last week, Milan, you brought something up about how much the whites don't realize how much blacks mistrust the whites. And I was wondering if that was an issue for you as couples, and if it was, how did you deal with it?
Well, my feeling was yes, I feel that way, but I also said that I think the key to it all is individuals. If I walk into a room full of white people, I'm scared for a minute or two until I connect with some individuals where, you know, I can sense that there's some energy or something there, and then my fear level goes down. And I think with Netter and I, it was all, we met each other and were friends for a year or so, and we had mutual friends and stuff like that. So it wasn't, it was all on a individual basis. It wasn't like dealing with an institution. And since we had mutual friends who I trusted and she was friends with them, then I trusted her, that sort of thing. But it wasn't an issue really, not with us.
I didn't hear that form last week. I just would respond from my personal experience and from what I've perceived, it's not only a matter of how much black folk don't trust white folk, it's how hard it is for black folk to trust anyone And it really does have to be an individual, a one-by-one deal, because the way that the culture has developed racism, the very things that we accuse you of doing to us, we do to one another in different settings. So it really does have to be one another. Let me just say one thing, and the big difference there is we don't have any choice. You can't grow up, it's very difficult to grow up black or Hispanic in this country and not deal with white folk. But most of you, Netter points that out in the very beginning, that you can live most of your lives and never see a black person or a Hispanic person, and certainly not see one in authority.
Or in your home.
Never have to have a relationship.
Mm-hmm. Never have to learn the culture, understand
the
culture.
Absolutely. One of the discussions we're having in places in the ELCA right now is that exact issue of the fact that I, as a black person, have to know what it means to survive in a white world and a white male-dominated system. I have to know what that's about. And somewhere in there, I have to really know who I am as a black woman also. Mm-hmm. And those things, I mean, it's like living in a schizophrenic world. I mean, it, yeah.
I'm sorry, Leanne, you want to answer that question?
I just was going to speak to the trust issue. And part of it is what I talked about last week in another forum, that is my, I mean, as much as Peter and Ron and Sarah grew up learning to test and not to necessarily trust with good reason, I grew up assuming that I could trust everybody, you know? And having to relate with those different kinds of assumptions, and to learn about each other's assumptions, and to find out that part of that assumption on my part is racism. To take advantage of that and not to see where other people can't have that advantage. Where I can, you know, you and I can walk into any room and assume that people are going to like us. And that's racism. Right there. So that's, I think that I keep having to learn that again and again, and it's not fun. It's not easy. And Peter is confronted with that in the way I am. And I'm frustrated by his lack of trust in certain settings. And sometimes his lack of trust of me. Just because we're different people who grew up in different kinds of ways. And part of that is racial, and part of it is just who we are. And it's hard to separate it all out.
Mm-hmm. John, did you have a question?
I want to approach it from another angle. I was born in Holland, and I managed an American company's office in Seoul, Korea. Mm-hmm. I married a Korean woman. She told me that her family was heavily upset that she was going to marry one of those Western barbarians who is writing from the left to the right instead of from the top to the bottom. However, it was brought to me in another way by the family. Not that I was the barbarian who had no civilization, but she was not worthy to marry me. She was not a good cook, and they didn't really know whether she could make me happy. So it would be much wiser for me not to marry that unworthy woman. This came from the Korean side. Right? Then you come to America and they turn it the other way around. They say, why did you marry a Korean? Or even worse, did you have to marry a Korean? And then the answer, of course, which I put up is, why did you have to marry your wife? So, to me, the whole situation became hilarious. There may have been discrimination, there may still be discrimination in it, but I think it is so completely hilarious, or dumb, whatever you want to call it, that we could never, neither my wife nor I, ever would take it serious.
Well, John is really one for calling things dumb when they're dumb, and he just did it again, so thank you. Eva.
Yes, I wanted to respond to the black woman, white man thing. I happen to be in a relationship with a white man now for over a year, and I think it needs to be said that not only are there judgments on the white side, there's very much so on the black side too, because my father has always told me, you can marry any color, but do not marry a white man. And I don't think it came from a racist background, but I think it came from the fact that white men has always taken black women at will during slavery time. And that's when he would tell us that, you know, mixed kids didn't come about originally in this country from black men, you know, having sex with white women. It came about from white men having sex with black slaves. And so he always told me. And here I am in this relationship, and I haven't told him yet. Mm. I haven't told either of them. I probably won't. So it's real scary. And it's not only on the white side, it's on the black side too. Of the acceptance.
Sounds very painful for you. Thanks for sharing that, Eva. Other comments or questions?
I was wondering if there are other Hispanics or Native Americans or any Asians here that could speak out of that experience.
Are there Hispanics, Native Americans, or Asians here who can speak out of that experience? Is the question. Seem not to be.
I was reminded of the fact that Ed and I took a trip to Germany, or we were in Germany because of another trip, but we were in Germany last year. First time I'd ever been to Europe. And we took a week in Bavaria and drove around, went to Munich, and that was fine. But then Ed wanted to travel around by car to all of these little farm villages and see the chickens, and he'd drive up into somebody's yard, and here I am in the car with him, and I was scared to death because I felt really uncomfortable there, like what you all were talking about. And I thought, these people have never seen a black person, and I wouldn't get out. Ed kept wanting me to get out and come and look at this and come and look at that, and we were visiting all the churches, and you know how in this place churches have parsonages and the farms and everything right there. Ugh, that was really frightening for me. And I was not comfortable there at all.
But did you have any unpleasant experiences? I mean, you anticipated them. Did they actually occur?
No, I stayed in the car.
No one could see through those windows. You pulled out.
Well, they could see in the windows, but I was not encroaching upon their space.
I think that speaks to Sarah's question to Roland about the trust level. I mean, it's very difficult to understand how reticent we are often to make contributions, having those contributions subverted, stolen, or denigrated previously. I have a funny Germany story. It's out of, I'm sure, this man's desire to be efficient and polite. As we rode the train out of Berlin to the rest of the free world, this was 12 years ago, it was the summer we were married, I hear the customs guy coming down, Rise of Passport. Leanne and I were sitting in the same, the dining car, in the same, you know, facing each other. And he says to Leanne, Rise of Passport, you know, passport, please. And he looks at me and says, passport, please. Yeah. So everybody down the line, every single person down the line he asked, he spoke to in German, he got to me, he spoke to me in English. And I was there to learn German.
Well, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Bella.
I mentioned this in yet another form last week that my experience in Europe was totally different. Europe was the very first time in my life when I ever really felt free. I felt what it's like not to be hated or not to be afraid in a small town, in a little shop somewhere. And I just kind of went crazy. I got these little tests that I do when I go places, because in America, you know, I sit on a bus and nobody sits next to me. You know, little kids are afraid, old ladies clutch their purses. But when I go to a place and I want to test it, I get on the bus and see who sits next to me. And it's, you know, it's worked in Canada and in other places. I sit there and old ladies sit next to me in Europe, and same way with Canada. Young children, you know, that kind of thing. And I said, well, this place is okay because these people aren't showing any fear of me as a black person. And I was totally, I felt better in small towns in Europe than I would ever feel in one in the U.S. Coming across here from Minnesota here, never likes to eat in these quaint little places and see what the food's like. And it scares me to death. I mean, we went in this one place and
Sundance, Wyoming.
I just could not eat. I had no appetite.
You had pork chops.
Oh, that, okay, yeah, that was, yeah, the pork chops were good, but I didn't like the people. But it was scary because, you know, people would just, a hush would come over the place.
Everyone had cowboy hats.
And they had cowboy hats, you know, signs of the enemy. Cowboy hats and boots. And little children would, like, stare at you, you know, and that kind of thing. And in Europe, if little children stared at you, number one, you know they didn't see a lot of black people in Europe. It's not like in the U.S. where you see black people on TV and stuff like that.
With guns.
But it wasn't fear in Europe. In Europe, it was kind of curiosity, and I'd wave at them, and they'd smile and wave back. In America, I wave at them, and they just kind of, you know, their mothers have to pull them away because, you know, they're just staring so hard. And that kind of thing. And that's just my European versus American experience. But
yeah, I mean, your question was, does anything bad ever happen? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it mostly has to do with people who just can't stop staring.
Verlon and I are college classmates, and we took a trip together, and I'm really disappointed to hear that wasn't the first place you felt really free.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about Georgia.
We took a trip through Selma, Alabama, down through Miami, and then we flew over to Jamaica. And the intent was noble. It was to allow a dozen basically German students to understand what it was like to be out of your culture in Jamaica. And they always needed some sort of tour guides, so there were scholarships for, at least for me, I think for Verlon too.
No, they made me pay.
Oops. I'm sad to hear that you didn't feel really free in Jamaica.
when we went this The guy who was leading the group was this psychologist, you know. So he was in all of this touchy-feely stuff. So he made us, every time we stopped at a gas station, he made us switch cars so we wouldn't farm bonds and be two separate cliques when we got down to when we got to Jamaica. So it just so happens that Pete and I are in the car with three white women when we go through Georgia at night. You know, we weren't thinking anything of it other than I hope we don't have to stop. Well, naturally, the women had to go to the bathroom. So they say, let's go to the bathroom. And I'm thinking, why don't we just pull over and you can just see that? I wouldn't bother me. So, but no. They wanted to stop at a rest at a filling station. So they stop at this filling station and get out. Pete and I are in the back seat thinking, maybe we shouldn't get out. But we get out anyway. And this is the honest to God truth. There was a guy there dressed like the sheriff that you see on all of those, what are those?
You in a heap of trouble, boy.
Yeah. I mean, in the same uniform and everything. You know, a big guy, just like in those Burt Reynolds movies. You know, what is it when he's Smokey and the Bandit guys. And he and this other guy were standing there, and they're looking dead at me and Pete, you know. While the women run into the restroom, you know, and Pete and I are standing there, and it's kind of like, you know, even if I had to do it, I couldn't. It's like, you know, everything that you had to do just turned around and went right back where it was. But it was a scary, frightening experience.
Okay, there's a question back there. Let's get that one.
I don't know if the stories would be funny or sad or some of each, but I'm wondering what it's been like for you in the church.
Funny, sad.
Yeah. Well, we only laugh about things that are really serious, you know. That's why I think there's a lot of laughter getting in. And sometimes the things that we're really nervous about, we laugh about. But I'm a United Methodist pastor, and serving in the Northern Illinois Conference. And one of the reasons I'm serving there is because the Florida Conference sort of ordained me, praying that I would leave, because they spent most of the time in my ordination to grilling session with our Board of Ordained Ministry, which is like your what? Professional leadership?
I don't know what it's called now.
Something
like
Canada. They really had a hard time dealing with my marriage in Florida.
And mine.
Yeah. And, I mean, questions like, from clergy, from white clergymen, things like, do you really think there's a church anywhere that would have you? So I went to, I sort of got ordained praying that the particular hands on my head that it would take in spite of those particular hands. I transferred to Northern Illinois thinking, okay, here's this liberal big city, Chicago, I've had two appointments that didn't make it because...
You need to describe the appointment process real quickly. Real quickly.
We have bishops who really work. I mean, who really have to... The bishops in the United Methodist Church appoint the clergy. You know what that means. We are an itinerant system, so that the bishops with their sort of assistants called district superintendents place clergy based on gifts and graces. So if there's a place that has need for someone with the kinds of skills and personality and that sort of thing that I have, the bishop will hopefully make that connection. And the church can say, I don't think you were thinking clearly on this one. We really need this skill that she doesn't have. But the fact that I'm a woman or the fact that I'm white is not a good enough reason for them to say no. And the next person they get may be also white and a woman. They don't know that. So they can't, the churches have therefore been able to experience the leadership of a wide variety of people because of this system. Well, when a candidate goes to a church, the appointment is already really made. It's just a sort of a formality to make the covenant happen. And we've been to several of these committees, and I've been appointed 5 times and served 3 churches.
One was because the ministry was so effective in just the 4 days that she was appointed there. They hadn't been able to get together on anything for the last 15 years. And when the members of the Pastor Parish Committee, which is a sort of a combination call committee,
personnel
committee, went home and told their husbands and wives who was appointed and who her husband was, in those 4 days, the whole, not only the whole congregation, but the whole community got organized around the issue.
There was there were anonymous phone calls that were threatening to burn down the parsonage and.
Oh yeah. Yes.
You forgot about that?
Well, I just the volunteer fire department can't be sure that they could get across the street in time if something were to happen to the parsonage. Literally across the street.
Okay. And
that's their church. Doesn't happen.
But you know, I give
yes,
the.
Yes, it does. We can yeah. tell you what.
Yeah, there was one other where the congregation, again, got so organized that they called a special charge conference, which is a congregational meeting, which requires 60% of the signatures of members. That's 60% of the membership to sign a petition to call a special charge conference. And they eliminated the position at this special charge conference, so I wouldn't have to come. Mm-hmm. And this is after I had been interviewed by the committee, and they had voted unanimously for me to come. When the rest of the congregation heard, you know, the filter down, and they hadn't met us and seen what wonderful people we are, they started imagining things, and it had to do with the youth group. What are the youth going to think?
Youth ministry is part of the job.
Yeah, youth ministry. What kind of model is this for our youth? You know, two people who have been married to each other for, you know, 5 years and
serve the church.
Yeah, this is a bad example. But that's where I'm convinced that it has to do with sexuality again. You know, that they don't want.
Well, you were 7 months pregnant.
I was. And in that case, there was another threatening phone call, you know, I decided at that point, the bishop gave me the prerogative to decide if I really wanted to go there, and with a child on the way, I didn't think I did want to subject her to that kind of an environment. So Peter was feeling bad about the fact that because I'm married to him, I've sort of lost a couple of opportunities in ministry. And I told him, you know, they're not opportunities that I would have gone there.
You were spared.
But I was spared. I really was.
And same thing happened to us.
Mm-hmm.
I was with an agency in Arizona, and the bishop there asked me to go to San Diego to interview at a church, and I wasn't particularly interested in going back into a parish, but I went. We both went, and we had 3 different weekends there, and it kind of felt good. And it was a downtown church, and we're very urban people, and missed the streetlights here and stuff like that. And, got to the point of a vote, and we were there one Sunday, and the next Sunday there was a vote. Well, there was a big campaign took place, and the vote was the 60 to 60. And the reasons we heard were fear that the congregation would turn black because of all the power that Sarah has.
All right.
And, you know, crazy stuff like that.
Yeah.
So we were spared, too. The ironic thing is that after me, they called a pastor who 2 years later came out of the closet.
He was really black?
No. But they got rid of him too.
Can I tell
please
a story?
Please do.
I feel like I'm an Oprah.
Our goal tonight was for people not to feel like you're on Oprah.
But three little quick things.